Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a chemical spill into the Elk River just north of Charleston, West Virginia, that has resulted in 300,000 local residents not having access to safe water to drink or bathe in for 4 days. David Gutman, a staff writer with the Charleston Gazette, joins us to discuss the role of the company that has existed in its current form for less than 2 weeks, responsible for the contamination, Freedom Industries, one of whose founders was charged in 2005 for failing to pay more than $200,000 in income tax, and who in 1987 pleaded guilty to selling between 10 and 12 ounces of cocaine. Then we will speak with Russian-American journalist Masha Gessen, who wrote the searing expose of Russia's president, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. We will discuss her latest book, Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot, and Putin's recent gestures of magnanimity in releasing Mikhail Khodorkovsky from prison after 10 years. Then on December the 23rd, two of the members of Pussy Riot, who were given 2-year prison sentences from a Soviet gulag ahead of Putin's showcase event, the upcoming Sochi Winter Olympics. Then finally, we'll look into the just-released report from the nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics, Millionaires Club. For the first time, most lawmakers are worth $1 million plus. An author of the report, Sarah Briner, the research director at the Center for Responsive Politics, joins us to discuss how the median net worth of our current 530 lawmakers as of May 2013 is $1,008,767, meaning that for the first time in our history, half of our representatives in Congress not only represent the 1%, they are the 1%. And joining us now is David Gutman, who's a writer for the Charleston Gazette, where he has just wrote the article, Freedom Industries Execs Are Longtime Colleagues. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Gutman.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
And this company, in its current form, is, 2 weeks old? That's Freedom Industries. So what was the reshuffle about?
Well, it's still a little unclear right now. On the last day of 2013, four companies merged into Freedom Industries. Freedom Industries already existed, and it merged with three other companies, two of which are right here in the Charleston area. They're called Etowah River Terminal and Poca Blending. And it is actually the Etowah River Terminal is the spot where the chemical leak happened.
And the chemical itself apparently is used in washing coal. What's that process about?
The chemical is, yes, it's used in processing coal. It's sometimes called a sudsing agent. The big thing is we know very, very little about the chemical. It's called crude MCHM. And the Centers for Disease Control is now saying that water is safe if it has less than one part per million of crude MCHM, although it seems that it's a little unclear where they got that number from, and it seems that that number is based on just one study done by a private company in 1990.
So let's turn to Freedom Industries and the work that you've done in uncovering its executives and their history. Let's start with Kathy Stover Kennedy, the girlfriend of Freedom Industries executive Dennis P. Farrell. She was the first to go public. This leak was first detected, I believe, at 4 p.m. On Thursday. At the plant that's just downriver from the leak that supplies the water to the neighborhood, they shut down. When did they shut down?
So it's the timeline is a little unclear. The State Department of Environmental Protection was getting reports that there was a licorice odor in the area as early as 8:15 on Thursday morning. We now know that the licorice odor was caused by the chemical leak. Freedom Industries, in their one kind of official public statement, said that they discovered the leak. Two workers discovered the leak at 10:30 on Thursday morning. So, you know, over 2 hours after we were out deep, the state government was already getting complaints. They said that when they discovered it, they immediately began containment measures and reported it to the state authorities. That is also in conflict with what state authorities have said, who said that when they arrived on the scene around noon, containment was not going on, and the spill had still not been reported.
But the first spokesperson for Freedom Industries was this girlfriend of the executive.
Well, I think it's a little unfair to call her a spokesperson. She has been the only person to kind of say, well, other than a brief press conference with the Freedom Industry president, she has been the only person connected to Freedom Industries to say anything. But what she said was written on her personal Facebook page, and so, you know, she certainly said it, and she said things defending the company and her boyfriend, who's a company executive, but it, you know, I wouldn't necessarily call it an official statement from the company.
But what she said is on her Facebook page, "I'm not asking for anyone's sympathy, but a little empathy wouldn't hurt. And just so you know, the boys at the plant made and drank coffee this morning. I showered and brushed my teeth this morning, and I'm just fine." How many other people have taken her advice on that?
Gosh, I hope not too many, because you know, state, the governor, the water company, everybody is still saying, you know, there is a do not use order in effect for parts of 9 counties in West Virginia, covering about 300,000 residents who get their water from West Virginia American Water Company. And do not use doesn't mean just don't drink the water. It means don't wash your hands, don't wash clothes, don't wash dishes. Do not boil it. Don't cook with it. Don't do anything except flush the toilets.
And certainly not brush your teeth.
Absolutely not. No.
So, again, I'm speaking with David Gutman, his reporter with the Charleston Gazette, where he just wrote the article, "Freedom Industries Execs Are Longtime Colleagues." So let's talk about this fellow, the co-founder of the company, Carl L. Kennedy. Along with Gary Southern that you mentioned, who made a brief statement. He apparently, according to your reporting, in 2005, federal prosecutors charged him with failing to pay more than $200,000 in income tax. And in 1987, he pleaded guilty to selling between 10 and 12 ounces of cocaine. Where is he now, this fellow?
That's a good question. He is decidedly below the radar right now. We've been unable to contact him or even determine if he is still in the Charleston area. He is still listed on the with the West Virginia Secretary of State as the incorporator of Freedom Industries, although he's not listed on Freedom Industries' website. And before Freedom Industries completely stopped answering their phones, a woman who answered the phone there said that he has not been with Freedom Industries for years, although he did, in his bankruptcy filing in 2005, he did list that he was the owner of 5% of Freedom Industries.
So what's but in terms of the warning to all of the people, 300,000 residents in this neighborhood are still without water. Apparently it's been difficult for people to get water. It really sort of shows you, I guess, and you're living through this, are you not, David? And it shows you, I suppose, just how basically dependent we are on such a simple thing as clean and safe water. Is that the wake-up call for everybody? Because even the government itself, in issuing these warnings, the government is shut down, is it not?
No, it is not. No, it is not officially shut down. State government, I believe, is scheduled to be open for business tomorrow, although the state legislature is still kind of in flux as to what they're doing tomorrow. But yeah, you know, this makes you realize how many things you use water for. The federal and state and local officials have actually been quite good in setting up water distribution sites all over the affected area. They've brought in tankers from neighboring states with water, and they've brought in, you know, tractor trailers and pallets full of bottled water. So there, you know, there at least haven't been many reports of people not having water to drink. But you know, it's tough to wash your hands with a bottle of water. It's almost impossible to take a shower with a bottle of water. You can't really wash your dishes with a bottle of water. You certainly can't wash your clothes with a bottle of water. So yeah, it is decidedly inconvenient to not have any running water.
So lots of 5 o'clock shadows around, right? People haven't shaved.
Seems like the city is getting a little riper as the days go by.
Well, obviously, it's not a laughing matter, and it's a very serious matter. And David Gutman, again, a reporter with the Charleston Gazette, Do you have any idea of how many people drank that water before? I mean, from the time it was first detected, the licorice smell, to the time that the first warning came out was what, how many hours?
Well, I mean, as I said, the first licorice smells were reported not in the water, but just in the air, in the area, at around 8:15 Thursday morning.
Mm-hmm.
And according to West Virginia American Water Company, they, around 4 o'clock that afternoon, was when they first detected the licorice odor in the water that was coming through the water treatment plant. And then pretty soon after that, around 5 o'clock Thursday, the do not use order went into effect. So, you know, we're talking of a span of, you know, 9 hours between when smells in the air were noticed and until the do not use order went into effect. And, you know, who knows how much longer after 5 o'clock until everybody, you know, it takes a minute to get that kind of order out to just, you know, from not everybody's watching TV or reading the newspaper constantly. So.
So it's almost a whole working day of contaminated water, so it's difficult to determine how many people either drank it, washed their clothes, showered, or brushed their teeth in it, right?
It is. I mean, I can tell you that I went to get a sip of the water fountain at work here on Thursday. I think it was around 4 o'clock on Thursday, and took a sip, and it tasted kind of like Robitussin, and that was the last sip of water I've had since.
So, and there aren't any peer review studies on this chemical, are there, that are that definitive, particularly in terms of how many parts per million are permissible?
That is correct. There are no peer reviewed studies. There is one non peer reviewed study from a company called Eastman Management, which makes this chemical, and they issued a study in 1990, and that's kind of what the Centers for Disease Control have been working off of as they've tried to kind of, I guess, I don't know, cobble together a safe limit for how much of this chemical is safe.
So what is the connection then with Freedom Industries and the coal industry? Because there have been quite a lot of reporting, particularly from a colleague of yours, there at the Charleston Gazette, is it Mike Elk Jr.? Is that right?
No, he is not at the Gazette.
Oh, he's not at the Gazette.
Ken Moore Jr.
Ken Moore Jr. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. He has been covering some of the characters in the coal industry. Many of whom have sued him. What is the connection between this? In this company and the coal industry, apart from the fact that the chemical is used to in processing coal or washing coal, which I take it is the process.
Right. Well, I mean, the Freedom industry is in large part owes its existence to the coal industry. Much of what they do is distributing chemicals that are used in mining. Beyond that, I mean, specific ties to specific coal mines and things like that, I think we're not quite sure yet. But, you know, certainly mining is a big industry here in West Virginia, and there are a number of, you know, firms like Freedom Industry that are here to serve the mining industry.
And the Eastman Chemical Company that makes the chemicals, of course, they are the famous Eastman Kodak Company from Rochester, I believe.
That I'm not sure of.
Right. I think they were founded by the same person.
Okay.
But so what then, I mean, you've got, there's no sense when this is going to end, right? How much can the, what's the process of dilution that's going on? I mean, how...
Well, we hope to learn more about that. There's a press conference scheduled with the governor and emergency officials and the water company scheduled for 4 o'clock, so in about an hour and 45 minutes. What they told us last night was that they need 24 consecutive hours of testing water samples, and they need 24 straight hours of all of those water samples to be below one part per million before they can begin flushing the system. And then once they begin flushing the system, we were told it could take, quote, several days before water is restored. The samples released by the governor's office last night, they released 18 water samples, and 10 of them were below the 1 parts per million threshold, although, but 8 of them were still above. And that is kind of last, that was around 9 o'clock last night, and that is the last word we've had.
So before you use your drinking fountain at work, I mean, what are you going to do? Flush it out too? I mean, it's one thing, right, for the company to flush the system, but doesn't it require every consumer to flush the system?
That is also information we're still waiting on from both the government officials and the water company. They have said we are going to flush the system, and then once that is done, they said they're going to give out specific instructions on what everybody should do, and they kind of indicated it would be something like turn on your hot water for 20 minutes and then turn on your cold water for 20 minutes. But, you know, it was very vague, and they also stressed that these are not things you should be doing yet because that will just disrupt their flushing. So right now we're doing nothing. Sometime in the future, everybody will be doing some sort of personal flushing, if you will, but we're not exactly sure what it'll involve.
Well, David Gutman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with David Gutman, who's a reporter for the Charleston Gazette, where he just wrote the article, Freedom Industries Execs, a longtime colleague. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Marcia Gessen, the author of the new book, Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot.
This time I know I'm bound to spit it back up. I didn't want this salty substitute. Just not going to do, I need some air. If I'm going to live through this.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Marcia Gessen, who's a Russian-American journalist and author of several books, most recently the national bestseller, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. She has contributed to Vanity Fair, The New Republic, Granta, and Slate, among other publications, and has served as editor of the Russian-language magazine Snob, and was fired as the editor of Around the World for not covering Putin's stunt of flying with the cranes. Her latest book, just out, is Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marcia Gessen.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And I guess our congratulations in order, in as much as you now become an American. Well, you have been an American, but now you've moved to the United States, right?
I am an American again, yes.
You are.
Re-immigrated after more than 20 years.
And is there some sense of sorrow and loss that you've – I mean, tell us why you don't feel comfortable in your former homeland.
Right. Well, I'm a lesbian, and my partner and I have 3 children together. So the anti-gay campaign that the Kremlin has been waging has had a direct effect on us, and we feel that we have a well-founded fear that the authorities will go after our kids. In fact, they've said as much, so we had to leave the country. We really had no choice. There's obviously a sense of loss because, you know, unlike most people actually anywhere, I made a conscious choice to live where I was living. I moved back to Russia after more than 10 years in the States. My family had immigrated here when I was a teenager. And I had made my home there. So, yeah, losing your home, especially when you're in, well, maybe not especially, but anyway, losing your home when you're in your late 40s and you feel very, very rooted and entrenched is incredibly difficult. That said, there are certainly worse places to end up than New York City.
Well, Marcia, though, it does seem that that these laws, these homophobic laws that were put through by Putin and United Russia, they they do have a kind of vigilante component, don't they? They say that it's all about protecting children. So that's where the threats are. And aren't sort of homophobic thugs, in a way, free to enforce the law?
Absolutely. And that's been very clear. There's been a huge rise in anti-gay violence and all sorts of anti-gay violence, sort of organized for the cameras violence and random street violence. And violence among people who are acquainted with one another, who can identify one of their acquaintances as gay. Some of the very few people who have been apprehended for this kind of violence do claim a patriotic motivation.
And what's your sense then of the failure, in effect, to get a boycott going against Sochi? I mean, I know the United States appointed a gay American to head up their Olympic delegation, but it would seem to me that Putin's assurances that no visitors are going to be harassed in any way misses the point.
Right. There was never a consensus in Russia or outside of Russia about whether there should be a boycott. I think there was a consensus sort of going into the fall that there should be a political boycott. And so far, that's not going too badly. I mean, a political boycott is essentially asking heads of state not to go, highly placed officials not to go, and starting in early December, the presidents of Germany, France, Poland, Lithuania, Estonia, and a couple of other countries have said that they're not going. And President Obama appointed a brilliant delegation. It's actually there are no highly placed government officials in either the opening ceremony or the closing ceremony delegation. That is the first time that's happened in a couple of decades. And there are several openly gay athletes in both of those groups. The group that's going to be at the opening ceremonies is headed by the University of California president, Janet Napolitano, and the group that's going to be at the closing ceremonies is headed by a deputy secretary of state. So it's a wonderfully designed snub.
So, again, I'm speaking with Marcia Gessen, a Russian-American journalist and author of several books, most recently the national bestseller, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. She has contributed to Vanity Fair, The New Republic, Granter, and Slate, among other publications, and has served as the editor of the Russian-language magazine Snob and was fired as editor of Around the World for not covering Putin's stunt of flying with cranes. Her latest book just out is Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. And I wasn't aware that the punk prayer actually does incorporate the conversation we've been having so far, Marcia. Just reading the words of the punk prayer that was performed in the boom to the music of the boombox inside the cathedral that led to the arrest or the flight of two of the members and the arrest of the other three, two of whom you've had close contact with. The punk prayer, just reading a couple of lines. Virgin Mary, Mother of God, chase Putin out. The Phantom of Liberty is up in heaven. Gay pride sent to Siberia in a chain gang. Virgin Mary, Mother of God, become a feminist. Give me a sense then of how this kind of the narod, the populace at large, which does have a lot of both racial prejudice and sexual prejudice, how are they responding? What's your sense of the extent to which these courageous young women have changed minds or opened minds?
Right. Well, yes, I'm glad you pointed that out, because I think that it's incredible that Pussy Riot are as good as they are at sort of pointing at the key issues of the day. At the time that they performed the punk prayer, which is almost 2 years ago, which is the protest at the Cathedral of Christ the Savior that got them arrested, at that time it wasn't clear to most people, certainly wasn't clear to me, that the anti-gay campaign was going to become a key issue in Putin's crackdown. In fact, Putin's crackdown began with the arrest of the members of Pussy Riot, which also happened on the date that he was supposedly reelected to his third term as president. As to their ability to change minds, I think that that would be much too much to ask. In a country where the media are controlled by the state and have been since these women were in grade school, it would be unrealistic. What they have done is forced several important issues on the liberal intelligentsia, and I think that's been very important. They have forced the liberal intelligentsia to think about sort of the limits of appropriateness in protest, which is an increasingly important issue for the Russian opposition. They have forced the issue of the symbiosis of church and state, and whether it is any longer acceptable for somebody who identifies as being anti-regime to also identify as belonging to the Russian Orthodox Church. That's a heart-wrenching, gut-wrenching issue for a lot of people in the opposition. And, of course, they actively predicted the anti-gay campaign. And that's been also something that is for the liberal intelligentsia to choose, you know, which side of history to be on. And I'm happy to report that I think most of them, all thousands of them, have made the right choice. But you know, hate sells very well, and I think hate sells very well anywhere. And I think if you imagine this country, I'm in New York now, where their airwaves are completely controlled by a rabid, xenophobic, homophobic entity, which beams to 98% of the households these messages of hate 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year. I think that would have a profound effect. It's an easy message to get and an easy message to deliver. And the space available for the independent media keeps getting smaller, even, you know, past the point where we thought it couldn't get any smaller.
And it would seem that there was also a political message, or hardly an accident, that the punk prayer took place in the cathedral. The Russian Orthodox Church patriarch, who wears a $40,000 watch, didn't he make a prayer thanking God for Putin?
He did. He not only he has actually compared Putininess to godliness. He has attributed Russia's economic prosperity under Putin in equal part to God's will and Putin's wisdom. He campaigned heavily for Putin in the lead up to his election in March of last year, and he also directed Russian Orthodox believers not to participate in protests.
So this is a little odd, is it not? This is a blending of church and state in a toxic display of racism and homophobia. But I suppose in this country you can make the analogies with elements in the religious right who are also homophobic. And of course, in the South, there's a residue of racism. So, is there a similarity there? I mean, obviously, for anybody who truly understands Christianity, this is the religion of love, not the religion of hate.
Well, I'd like to make 2 points about that. First of all, there's more than a similarity. There's a direct connection. The United States has been exporting its extreme right to Russia for the last couple of years. The people who can hardly get a pulpit in this country anymore are lecturing to the Russian parliament on family values. This has it's sort of come full circle. Russia is now aspiring to being the traditional values capital of the world, and it has the assistance of several prominent American Christian fundamentalist activists in this quest. As for Russia itself and the Russian Orthodox Church itself, there's a long history of the church doing the state's bidding. In fact, that history goes back to Peter the Great. And more recently in the Soviet period, the church hierarchy was closely linked to the KGB. So the patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church and Vladimir Putin, a former KGB agent, come from the same corporation. They really are in symbiosis.
So, Masha Gessen, again, the author of the new book, Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. Let's turn to the women themselves, and particularly the two that you had extensive access to, as well as their families. Nadija Telekonikova who you interviewed in the Gulag, right? And then Maria Alihina, who you also had corresponded with extensively. Explain how that was done, given the kind of police state nature of Putin's Russia.
Right. So three members of three participants in that action were arrested in March of 2012. They were Nadezhda Tolokolnikova, who is sort of the mastermind behind Pussy Riot, Maria Alyokhina, and Katerina Samutsevich. Samutsevich was got a suspended sentence. So she was also sentenced to 2 years, but her sentence was suspended. She was released in October. And two, Maria and Nadezhda, were shipped to penal colonies, which, as we have found out, in many ways, thanks to them and their recent work starting in prison, have changed very little since the times of the Gulag. They're still based built on slave labor and humiliation and torture. I started corresponding with Nadia and Maria. Their lawyers asked them for permission to talk to me. Communication with lawyers is largely confidential. And then, following some simple guidelines, we could correspond using the online system for corresponding with inmates. One of the guidelines was that I was using a pseudonym. I signed my letters Martha Rossler, who's an American contemporary artist, with whom I think I have very little in common, so that caused me some discomfort. But this was the pseudonym chosen for me by Nida, so that was the easiest thing to use. In addition, Maria gave me access to the letters she had written from prison to family and friends. And, of course, that was much more open and intimate than anything she could have written to me. We were strangers, basically, before I started writing the book. It also gave me a long view, because she started writing those letters when she was first in pretrial detention, and you can see her evolution. So there are extensive excerpts from those letters in the book, and I think that that's some of the most striking material in the book, because she's also, among other things, a remarkable writer. And Nadia and I had extensive correspondence over the course of several months, and then her friends and her husband were kind enough to give me a spot on one of the meetings with her, because you get inmates get one short-term visit, one four-hour visit every 2 months, and two adults can be present, and one child. So I accompanied Nadia's husband, Peter, to one of those visits, and basically it was a four-hour interview, which is a very long and intense interview by any measure, but of course, being the only journalist who was interviewing her in prison, aside from some journalists who interviewed her for state television for propaganda purposes, that was particularly intense. And it was a very important also conversation to keep in mind for my own understanding of her evolution in prison.
Well, I take it a lot of what was moving about the letters and about the situation that these young women are in is that they're both young mothers, right? And they've been denied access to their children, about a third of the children's lives missed their mothers?
This is correct. Their children are 5 and 6 years old. Nigel's daughter is 5 and Maria's son is 6. So, yes, they've missed a third of their lives. They were in prison for just under 2 years. And I actually watched Gera, Nadia's daughter, interact with her mother in prison, and it was very painful to watch. You could see them both being sort of physically uncomfortable with each other, longing for each other but not knowing how to act, missing a common language, the sorts of things that we take for granted when we talk to our kids. And, of course, it also sheds a little bit of light on Putin's amnesty, which knocked 2 months off of their sentences, because both Nadia and Maria appealed on several occasions to have their sentences either shortened or suspended or postponed until their children were older. There's a provision in the law for it, but they were both denied. The judge in one of Maria's hearings said, well, having a small child didn't prevent her from committing a felony, so there's no reason it should get her out of jail. And then Putin goes and amnesties women who have small children in a great show of humanitarian goodwill, so that their prison sentence is commuted from 2 years to 22 months.
And this followed, of course, the release of Mikhail Khodorkovsky from 10 years in prison. And it's clearly these acts of magnanimity from Putin are everything to do with the showcase that he's putting on in Sochi, I take it.
Absolutely. All of these, this actually happened simultaneously. The amnesty for Pusserat, the amnesty for the 30 Greenpeace activists who were kidnapped in international waters in September and held hostage for 3 months in Russia, and the release of Mikhail Khodorkovsky. And what makes it completely transparent is the fact that at the same time that these high-profile political prisoners were being released, people that you haven't heard about, like the environmental activist Yevgeny Vitishka, who has been very active in the campaign to expose human rights and environmental violations that are part of the Sochi construction, he was sentenced to 3 years in prison the day that Mikhail Khodorkovsky left jail.
So when you visited Nadia Telekhanikova in the Gulag, I take it that she describes how, the warden at the penal colony informed her that you should know that when it comes to politics, I am a Stalinist. So, I mean, you know, I guess what Putin has done in Russia is he's basically killed politics, right? There are no longer any politics in Russia. It's just a very cynical exercise. But has Stalinism returned, or is it getting a breath of fresh life?
Stalinism has certainly been so rehabilitated as part of the Russian legacy. But more than that, an intentional and well-articulated cruelty has become sort of all the fashion. That comment that Nadia heard from her warden is echoed by a comment one of the Greenpeace activists heard from his warden. His warden said, "I think that the Gestapo has gotten a bad rap." These guys are not only sadists, but they showcase their sadism. They get points for their sadism. Their sadism is an end in itself.
Well, much of the homophobic remarks directed at you and others in Russia are also sadistic, are they not? They're talking about gays should be burned alive.
Gays should be burned in ovens alive.
Well, that's obviously, back to the Gestapo again. I mean, it's difficult not to extricate that kind of hatred and thuggery and brutality from both in terms of racism and homophobia.
Yes, the historical references are clear, and sort of the absence of any kind of cultural judgment placed on those historical references is also clear. And that, I think, is exactly what makes contemporary Russia just such a scary place to live and certainly to raise children.
And that, I don't recall that happening in the Soviet Union because, you know, the Soviet authorities made such a big deal out of the Great Patriotic War. So I can't imagine that it was consistent with their propaganda to be pro-Nazi or to make...
Yeah, that's a very difficult thing to unravel because Putin also continues to make a very big deal of the Great Patriotic War. And the Great Patriotic War remains sort of the great unifier of all Russians, the last event in Russian history that more or less everybody can agree on. It's a great thing that the Soviet Union participated in defeating fascism, or if you listen to Russians, that the Soviet Union defeated fascism single-handedly. But somehow that does not extend to the nature of fascism. That does not extend to drawing a line between the ideologies and sort of the spirits of Stalinism and Hitlerism. There's good reason for that. Historically, there was never a huge ideological distinction. The Soviet Union and Nazi Germany were allies until Nazi Germany attacked. And right after the end of World War II, censorship kicked right back in, And any discussion of the Holocaust was basically heavily censored, if not outright excluded in Russia. So it has never been wrong in Soviet or Russian culture to hate others because they're other. In fact, it's been the dumb thing.
So leave us on a note if you can.
It's not, yes, I know. We're just going downhill, aren't we?
I know, I know. It just, you know, a little bit beyond despair, shall we say. You know, I'm not asking for much here, Marcia.
You know, I went back to interview Nadia and Maria right after they got out of prison. And they're an inspiration if there ever was one. They have used the 2 years in jail to grow, to educate themselves. And they have emerged. They went in as college students who had created this incredible prank that was brilliant, that was prescient, but that was a prank. They came out seasoned, articulate political activists. I still couldn't help being struck just by how young they look and sometimes sound, but I'm also struck by how brave they are and how determined they are. And if there's hope for Russia, they're it.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Marcia Gessen.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Marcia Gessen, who's a Russian-American journalist and author of several books, most recently the national bestseller, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. She has contributed to Vanity Fair, The New Republic, Granta, and Slate, among other publications, and has served as editor of the Russian language magazine Snob, and was fired as editor of Around the World for not covering Putin's stunt of flying with the cranes. Her latest book just out is Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about how the representatives of the 1% have become the 1%. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sarah Briner, who is the Research Director at the Center for Responsive Politics, who just released the report Millionaires Club. For the first time, most lawmakers are worth $1 million plus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sarah Briner.
Happy to be here.
And as I mentioned and mentioned in the opening, it does seem that the given now that as of May 2013, the median net worth of our current 350 lawmakers is $1,008,767, which to my interpretation means that the first time in our history, half of our representatives in Congress not only represent the 1%, they are the 1%. So is that the byline? Is that the takeaway here?
I think it's probably been the case that members of Congress have been members of the top 1% for a bit longer than that, because we have to remember their incomes put them in a higher income bracket anyway, and that money isn't even included in the net worth statistics that we released yesterday or last week. So I don't think it's necessarily the case that this is brand new. For the first time, we have really wealthy people serving in Congress, but I think that the sort of nugget here really encapsulates the type of people that we have serving in Congress right now. They are not your average American citizen.
So here in California, of course, we have the dubious distinction of having both the wealthiest member of Congress on that list, Representative Darrell Issa, whose net worth is between $330 million and $598 million. He, of course, was arrested as a car thief and then turned his talents into creating a company called the Viper Car Anti-Theft System that he's marketed. And then the poorest is Representative David Valadejo, another Californian Republican. His debts are $12.1 million, mostly apparently loans on his family's dairy farm. So if he's the poorest, you've got to be a millionaire to be in debt, don't you, at least to the tune of $12.1 million? I mean, presumably he hasn't declared bankruptcy, so he must have at least $12 million worth of assets.
Yeah, I can look at that, but I believe that most of his debt actually comes from investments in a dairy farm. Mm. Yes, he does have more than zero. His range is from negative $24 million to $164,000. So that's quite a range. It's really hard to pinpoint a member's specific net worth because of the way this information is disclosed, but it could be the case that he's worth positive amounts of money. We just don't have a good sense of that right now.
Well, of course, the other fellow with the top of the list, Daryl Issa, he's quite prominent because he's a grandstander who has a committee that goes on these wild goose chases, like looking into the some bogus arms sales in to Mexican cartels that was ginned up into the Fast and Furious scandal. The Benghazi thing, they've been beating a dead horse on that one for some time. So he's quite high profile. What's the is there any connection between having a lot of money in Congress and ending up with an important committee chairmanship?
I'm not sure about that. I don't think that it's common for the poorest members to be in high-profile leadership positions, but oftentimes leadership positions go to career politicians, people who have been in office for a long time. And the wealthiest members tend to be those who made their wealth prior to entering politics. You know, John Kerry may be a bit of an exception there. He actually married into wealth, but I don't think that the top of the list is not Mitch McConnell, John Boehner, Nancy Pelosi, although she actually is quite wealthy. So it seems to me to be a bit across the board. I think that having a lot of money does help you when you're fundraising. You know these people because you interact with them in your day-to-day life, and so you know the deep-pocketed donors who can help fund your campaign, and if you're in a safe district, your friends' campaigns as well.
Well, of course, we also have Senator Feinstein here in California, whose husband is extremely wealthy and has been given exclusive contract to dispose of the valuable properties of the United States Postal Service. And under California law, of course, she owns what he owns, at least half of what he owns. So one of the things I find extraordinary, though, is that aren't there more Democratic millionaires than Republican millionaires, or is it pretty even, Stephen?
It's fairly even at this point. The Republican senator tends to be worth more, slightly more than the Democratic senator. That's a change. We lost at least two very prominent, very wealthy Democratic senators. We lost them for the pool, Frank Lautenberg and Herb Kohl. And John Kerry tended to bring that value up a lot for Democrats in the past, and they're no longer serving in the Senate. So right now there's slightly an edge to the Republicans in the Senate, but only just barely.
And the first one you mentioned, of course, Lautenberg, his fortune came out of pharmaceuticals. Kohl is the big department store, right? Kohl's.
Right, although his wealth was almost entirely held in the Milwaukee Bucks basketball team recently.
I see. And then Kerry's wealth actually comes from his wife, who was married to a Republican senator, the heir to the Heinz 57 ketchup fortune, right?
Right.
So, and then Sensenbrenner, the congressman, the Republican congressman, I think isn't his family, aren't they the manufacturers of the tampon?
I'm not sure about that. A lot of these companies have very boring sounding names, so
right.
Until you poke around in them, you don't quite know exactly what they are, but that could be.
Right. Well, I'd say that would be a business that stays in business. So give me a sense then, if you don't mind, Sarah, of how this wealth is broken down in the Millionaires Club, which is for the first time, most of our lawmakers are worth more than $1 million. What do they put their money in, or what's their wealth largely? What comes up first as a flag in their wealth?
Sure. The most popular investment, I suppose you could call it, is actually real estate. And I think that surprises a lot of people. Most members hold most of their money in real estate. The very wealthiest, sort of the top of the top of the top, tend to hold their money in trusts. And most members, as far as investments on the stock market are concerned, tend to invest in very conservative, very, historically strong stocks. Or they hold their money in mutual funds, which some say is a way to prevent there appearing to be conflict of interest concerns, because they don't have to disclose the content of the mutual fund. They just disclose the fact that they have it. So generally, we don't have a lot of hedge fund investors in the Millionaires Club. It tends to be more conservative investments and, wealth vehicles.
It seems, though, that the most popular investment of the Congress, both senators and Democrats, is General Electric.
Right. That's the most popular stock.
And what are the other ones that they like?
There's Procter & Gamble is up there, again, a not particularly elastic or not particularly variable stock. I think some of the others are things like AT&T. I can go down the list. Microsoft, Wells Fargo, and that would be investing in the bank itself, not having an account there. Apple, Bank of America. So these are Fortune 500 companies, very large, very staid investments. Members of Congress, by and large, don't tend to take a great deal of risk where their investments are concerned.
But they're not required to put it into a blind trust, are they? Like, I think, heads of cabinet positions, the head of the CIA, for example, is required to do that.
No, they're not required to do so.
So where do we stand with the Stock Act? You recall that it was discovered that after 9/11, a prominent congressman from Alabama, who got all of the it wasn't 9/11, it was the 2008 crash. When they were in desperate shape and the Secretary of Treasury was on his knees begging Nancy Pelosi to help him out, and George W. Bush was absent without, AWOL, because he was in a state of shock, and the economy was just in free fall, apparently this congressman was making trades on inside information he was being given about the TARP program. So that led to, I believe, a 60 Minutes investigation that then led to some congressional action to put a wall between inside information that Congress people have and their ability to buy stocks that would benefit from this inside information. Where does that stand now? Because I understand it was watered down.
Right. The insider trading component stands as written, and so it is illegal for members of Congress to profit on their insider knowledge. The part of this that was watered down is really the part that makes it so that citizens can be aware of what their members of Congress are doing. It may surprise most people that members of Congress oftentimes hand write these disclosure forms. So that's their own personal handwriting, writing pages and pages of investment names, of amounts, and that information is filed on paper and released in PDF form, which we then have to hand enter into databases. And in my opinion, it's the 21st century. People could be filling these out electronically, and then individuals would have much easier access to become aware of what their members are invested in and where they get their wealth from, and not have to wait for a year and a half after the member may or may have bought stock or sold their house before they're aware of that transaction. So that component was removed quietly. A component that would have made those forms needed to be filed electronically was removed quietly last April to little fanfare. And that's unfortunate because it just really guts the ability for the Act to allow citizens to learn about these disclosure forms. So we thought that that was unfortunate. We wish that they would put it back in, but there doesn't tend to be a lot of energy to, these sort of legalistic, these very technical legal changes that would make it just a lot easier for people to learn about this.
Well, it hardly sounds like an accident. I mean, if you're one of the few watchdogs on Capitol Hill, the Center for Responsive Politics, that do this grunt work, you know, you're the ones that go through all these filings to let us know, the public and journalists know what's going on here. And it sounds like since you have discovered firsthand how difficult and how long it takes to get this information out from these handwritten documents, it would seem to me that that might have been the purpose of that change in the law.
Right. It was folded into a requirement that was designed to protect foreign diplomats who, through some component of the law, may have been required to disclose their addresses when they were living in foreign countries, which was a safety risk. But they didn't need to take out the entire electronic filing and electronic database component of that to protect the identities and safety of foreign diplomats, in our opinion. So we wish that that would go back into the back into the law. And it's just very difficult to – these forms are very technical, very complicated. Many members attach hundreds of pages of brokerage statements that we have to both hand enter and interpret. So this isn't the way it needs to be. It could be done more simply in a way that gave normal Americans the ability to learn about their abnormally wealthy members of Congress, and hopefully that will happen someday in the future. But until then, we will continue to hand enter pages and pages of technical data. So,
well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Sarah Briner.
No problem. Thank you so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Sarah Briner, who's the research director at the Center for Responsive Politics, who just released the report, Millionaires Club, for the first time, most lawmakers are worth $1 million plus. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer David Rochert. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.